Robert Morningstar joins us next with his perspective on the JFK assassination. We'll tell you all about him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Robert Morningstar is a civilian intelligence analyst and psychotherapist in New York City, received a degree in psychology from Fordham University, an expert, by the way, in Chinese language, history, martial arts, an FAA licensed pilot and instrument ground instructor with 23 years of flying experience. Robert has studied the paranormal and UFOs for more than 40 years. He's one of the editors of UFO Digest. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. But he also was part of the exposing government cover-up and deception in the JFK assassination. And his work is cited in major books on the assassination. Let's bring him into Coast to Coast. Robert, my pleasure. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you, George. Nice to make your acquaintance.
I got you up in the wee hours up there in New York, but it's such an important moment, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly is. It's a marathon for me. I think 20 hours that I've been going.
Oh, my gosh.
I've already done another radio show earlier. But it's my pleasure to be here, honestly. I admire your work and everything you do to get the truth out to people. And I'm very happy to be here.
This is an incredible night for us, Robert, because it's not only the 50th anniversary, but so many incredible researchers are bringing their specific theories. But the one thing I'm picking up, as I have over the last several years doing this program, that is Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, if he acted at all.
If he acted at all, correct.
Tell me how you got involved in this, in the assassination research.
Well, I got involved in the assassination because of my affection for President Kennedy. I was one of the earliest followers of President Kennedy, having latched on to him around 1957 and 58 when he was still a senator. And there were rumors. I was in there since the time there were rumors that he might run. And I was watching when he announced his candidacy. That's how far back I go. And then, of course, we all suffered the tragedy of this day 50 years ago today. I was in a biology class at Power Memorial Academy, whose claim to fame was the greatest high school basketball team of the era with Lou Alcindor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they don't know his name. Kareem Jabbar.
That's right.
I knew him when he was Lou Alcindor.
That's right.
So that day we were all struck. I'll never forget it. You'll never forget it. But when the cover-up began, let me say this. I had such affection for President Kennedy that I felt like he was my older brother. I looked up to him as my model. And when he was killed, I feel and felt about it then as anyone would feel if someone killed your brother.
Yeah.
You would never give up the quest to get the truth and to find the killers or the agency that did it. So that is basically it. It's a spiritual relationship that I have with President Kennedy. I have no qualms about saying it.
So many different theories, Robert. Some say, you know, Kennedy and his brother Robert, you know, they went after the mob. They tried to kill Fidel Castro through the CIA. That it backfired. It backfired on all of them. And I think Bobby Kennedy at some point before he was assassinated truly believed that maybe whatever he did, he may have contributed to his brother's death. What do you think of that?
Can I clarify that about the plot
absolutely.
On Castro? The plot on Castro started in 1958, so that was Nixon's doing.
Nixon and Eisenhower. Right?
Nixon and Eisenhower, but you see, we are privy now to documentation and history that was not available to us even 10 years ago. And I've pursued the lead that was given to us by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. You'll recall that they said that the President Kennedy probably died as a result of the conspiracy involving organized crime. But over and above that, the Church Committee produced a document in which they cited the CIA's relationship with the mafia and, in passing, referred to plots against Castro, but in detail, and this is something everyone's overlooked, they cited certain groups within the CIA and the National Security Agency as focal points that one might look at in future. They weren't given access to the documentation, but they found out the names. And the names went in this sequence. It was kind of a molting process. One committee or one organization molted into the other. So it went like this. There was the Special Operations Group in the early 1950s. And these were all executive action committees. And when I say executive, I mean like execute. Okay? So it went from the Special Operations Group into the October 5th Committee, into the October 20th Committee, into the 5412 Committee. And I can tell you now that Colonel Fletcher Prouty, whom we all knew and know, his work on exposing this, he referred to something called the secret team. But he was never able to divulge the name of the secret team. Well, it's called the 5412 Committee. Excuse me. The 5412 Committee was initiated in the second administration of Eisenhower. And in order to protect Eisenhower with plausible deniability, he was not told about it. He was told in general, we have a plan to kill Castro. But he said, okay, you know, if you can do it with, you know, without it blowing back on us,
yeah,
go ahead. That's about, you know what I mean? He knew.
He basically pulled the Pontius Pilate routine, right?
Right. Well, the key is this, and you're going to be shocked by what I tell you in a few minutes. The committee was under the directorate of the Vice President of the United States, Richard Nixon. In league with the CIA and their Internal Affairs Bureau, counterintelligence, with James Jesus Angleton was involved in. Well, these committees all were in a nexus in the 5412 Committee. They had a representative from the FBI, CIA, NSA, and Attorney General, but under the director of the Vice President of the United States.
Was it clandestine, Robert, or was
absolutely,
it well-known?
Absolutely. This is the reason that the even the Church Committee was not given this information. You see, the CIA fought tooth and nail against cooperating with HSCA. So the gist of it is this. In 1958, a decision was made to enlist the mafia because if they got caught killing Castro, they were expendable. You could write them off and you could say they really had a reason. And actually, they really had a reason.
They did. They wanted their casinos back, right?
Not just that. I believe that there's a hoard, you know, like the treasure of Sierra Madre. I believe there's a hoard of money, gold, and hidden in Cuba, if Castro hasn't found it, that was cashed by the mafia. And when Castro came in, you know, people don't realize this. He gave the mafia 3 days to get out of town, and the only thing they could take were the clothes on their back.
That's right.
So all their holdings are there, and they've been dying for 50 years to get back in. That said, let me get back to the plot to kill Castro. They decided that this was a good idea, so they decided they had to have a cutout. They couldn't go directly to the mafia. So they said, let's find somebody. So they knew that Robert Mayhew, who ran the Howard Hughes operations in Las Vegas, had a lot of contacts.
Okay.
They approached him. So he said, yes, I'll do it for patriotic reasons. I'll introduce you to Johnny Roselli. Johnny Roselli comes in and he thinks, oh, you know, if we work, I'm patriotic, I'll be working for the government, we'll have a little protection, you know, a little cover. All right, I'll do it. So he goes and he talks to Sam Giancana in Chicago and tells him about the proposal. Giancana says, you know, this is a good idea. I think, you know, getting protection from the government, they're putting heat on us right now with the Kefauver Committee and all. So let's cooperate. But you know what? We can't go barging down into Cuba because that's Santos Traficante's territory. So we have to get approval from Santos Traficante. So Giancana contacts Traficante. They contact Roselli. They said, okay, we're willing to meet. And the CIA delegates a CIA officer named Sheffield Edwards, whose name you may have heard. We'll come back to his, a unique name.
We'll
a name I will never forget. The first time I read it, it just burned in my mind. So Sheffield Edwards met in Miami with Johnny Roselli, Sam Giancana, and Santos Trafficante on September 25th, 1959. They agreed to try to bring Castro down. And shortly thereafter, $10,000 was transferred to them to get the operation going. So that's where it stood in 1959 into 1960. Nixon is still the vice president. They're going, you know, full speed ahead on killing Castro and getting Cuba back, invading Cuba. They foresee that they're going to invade Cuba during the next administration.
I assume Nixon thought he was going to get elected.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And here's the kicker. Nixon expects to get elected. Giancana helps Kennedy get elected by rigging the election in Chicago, yeah. Right? All the voting machines went into the river. So Nixon wakes up a loser, and Kennedy wakes up the winner. And as a result, the directorate of the 54-12 committee devolves to Lyndon Johnson. So Lyndon Johnson inherited the assassination apparatus of the United States government in assuming the vice presidency of the United States. Again, Kennedy's not told about these plots until much later on. He's not told about the Bay of Pigs until the morning it happened. At which time they call him at 3 o'clock. That 3 o'clock in the morning call that, you know, what is her name? Clinton was talking about in her campaign. That 3 o'clock in the morning call came to President Kennedy, and it was the CIA, I believe it was Bissell, telling him, "Mr. President, we've begun the landings in Cuba. The anti-Castro Cubans have landed at the Bay of Pigs, and we need air cover." And he said, "What?" He said, "Air cover? What is this?" He said, "Oh, Mr. President, we've had this plan on, you know, since the Eisenhower days, and now they're caught up on the beach, and the planes that we had coming from Nicaragua aren't showing up, and we need immediate air cover." And President Kennedy says, "Hell no."
And goes back to bed, right?
Well, what are you guys doing? Basically, I would say, if it were me, what the hell are you guys talking about? You know, that's really his situation.
Oh, he must have been furious the
next
day.
Absolutely. Livid. Absolutely livid. And it was as a result of that he sacked Alan Dulles, Richard Bissell, General Richard Cabell, who was an Air Force officer, but he was the number three man at the CIA. And it just turns out that Richard Cabell is the brother of Earl Cabell, the mayor of Dallas, on the day President Kennedy was shot.
Do you think Kennedy at some point said, "What the heck have I gotten involved with here?" I mean, do you think he was in shock over how much lack of control a president might have had?
He was in total shock. In particular, not just the first shock of the Bay of Pigs fiasco, which he, you know, egg on his face, and he took it, assumed complete responsibility. He said, "Victory has 1,000 fathers, and failure is an orphan."
Yeah, he was right, and he never said anything about Eisenhower or Nixon, did he?
No, not at all. And then we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the Cuban Missile Crisis, as we all know, was something that Curtis LeMay loved because he expected to use that as a trigger for nuclear war with Russia. And I'm not kidding. I'm not talking about, land war. He had in mind, as he said, turning Russia into a radioactive heap of rubble for 300 years.
Well, did he contemplate the retaliation from the Soviets?
He was so foolish as to think that if we hit them with a first strike, nuclear strike, that we would minimize the damage. He was willing to lose millions of Americans in order to wipe out Russia.
Yeah, let's lose Wichita and St.
Yeah,
Louis.
Yeah, you know, Wichita, who cares about Wichita? You know, we can lose that as long as we don't lose New York. And New York was really well protected in those days. I don't know if you recall, but we had Nike bases
That's
surrounding.
Right.
There were Nike bases in Rockland County. You know, Nike.
And you know, and that was with 1960 technology, but it was still pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was mostly anti-bomber technology, you know, where we'd still have a warning, a lag time. However, with the intercontinental ballistic missiles coming in at in half an hour from Russia, and imagine, you know, just imagine, the nuclear missiles in Cuba were 10 minutes, I would say about 5 minutes from Miami, and 15 minutes from Washington, and half an hour from New York.
You're right.
But that was a quid pro quo, you know, that it was a gambit that Khrushchev tried in response for our Jupiter missiles in Turkey.
Do you think Kennedy went to Khrushchev, Robert, and simply said, you got to help me here. These guys are out of control.
I believe that happened. It actually happened. But it did not happen through official channels. And this is where Kennedy got into on the wrong side of everybody, the wrong side of the State Department, the wrong side of the CIA, the wrong side of the military, because President Kennedy solved the Cuban Missile Crisis with the help of a reporter named John Scali, who had a contact in the Soviet embassy. And it was over a coffee in a coffee shop in Washington, in a secret meeting, that John Kennedy delegated Robert Kennedy to go talk with John Scali to this Soviet attaché. And during those conversations, they were able to get that message exactly what you're saying, saying that he was under pressure from our military to go to war, and basically a call for help. And subsequently, President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev became really good friends. I was just watching a gentleman named Sanders, who's published a book on the letters of President Kennedy, and he cited 14 letters that went back and forth between President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, and one of them was 35 pages long.
Wow.
And yeah, it's amazing. But President Kennedy also installed the hotline and was talking to Khrushchev directly without notifying anybody else. And one of the big issues was UFOs, since our audience is interested in this aspect. This is the most secret aspect of the Kennedy assassination. And the burned memo that was revealed by Dr. Robert Wood and Ryan Wood about 3 years ago, nobody knew what that meant, you know? I looked at it, and, you know, my eyes popped out of my head when I read Lancer, and I read 5412 Committee, and the weather precipitation in Washington. All those were all code words, and I said, oh, my God, this is all related to the assassination. Why? Because I knew what the 5412 Committee was. I knew who Lancer was. Lancer was the secret code name of President Kennedy. His wife was Lace, and Johnson was Volunteer.
Uh-huh. All right.
So these were code words, so they could talk on radio, air, you know, like from Air Force One down to the ground. And if the Russians were tuning in to the frequencies, which they often did, you know, their spies would reveal our frequencies to them, so they'd be.
And Lancer, they grabbed from Lancelot, I bet.
I suppose so. Yeah. Lancelot.
Now, do you think Kennedy was going to reveal with Khrushchev information about UFOs?
Well, the fact is that the memo that I believe got him killed, there are a couple of memos that I believe got him killed. November 12th, he sent a memo. November 12th, 1963, 10 days before he was assassinated, he sent a memo to the Director of Central Intelligence, and not requesting, but demanding a reclassification of UFOs, not UFOs, unknowns. Their word for them were unknowns. President Kennedy feared there was so much secrecy and compartmentalization in secret black operations that the CIA did not know what the Air Force was doing, the Air Force didn't know what the Navy was doing, the Navy didn't know what anybody else was doing except their own. Each one was an eggshell. And we were mistaking our own black projects for hostile, possibly hostile craft and having reactions and alerts to them.
Robert, hold on. We're going to come right back. I want to talk more about the UFO angle here, and then we'll take some phone calls. Robert Morningstar, our final guest during our JFK special. We'll be right back. Well, what's a Friday night without our traditional shout-out? And thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. Those of you listening to your favorite radio stations across North America, hello and thank you. Coast Insiders, thank you so much. And Sirius XM, Indie Channel 104, and then the various chat rooms and groups, Imaginative Worlds, our dear friends there, Into Infinity, the National Radio Club, Fantastic Forum 2, the OmegaPointChronicles.com group, the Nighthawk Nation group, the Sorcery IRC, the Northern Kentucky Paranormal Group, the SoCal UFO Meetup Group, the Hollywood Ghost Hunters, and our buddy Greg the Cook in St. Louis. Thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast with Robert Morningstar. We'll take your calls in a second. So, Robert, basically we have, based on what I'm hearing from you, this Cuban situation, this black ops program that's going on. They want Kennedy out. And then let's talk a little bit more about this UFO situation. What do you think he was going to do there?
Well, here's the situation. We have this, we had this phenomenon of UFO intrusions over the Dew Line and the Bemuse Line coming in over Canada from the North Polar areas.
Okay.
And they were often mistaken for incoming Soviet ICBMs. And we would react, as I said, they'd pick them up in Cheyenne Mountain, and then they'd say, oh, my God, the Russians are coming. And they would put on an alert. Our missiles would open up their silos, getting ready for retaliation. And then all of a sudden, they'd see the fast walker slow, zip, change direction, go someplace else at incredible speed.
Not a missile.
Not a missile. Yeah, that's why they call them fast walkers, because, you know, that's like those bugs that walk on water. You know, anyway, Kennedy was concerned about this because every time there was an alert, he was alerted, right? He had the black box for answering up. One of the problems that he had with that is that we could not recover or recall the SAC. The Failsafe movie tells it all, you know, the Jack the Ripper.
Good point, because Jack the Ripper
was Curtis LeMay, by the way, that Dr. Strangelove version. And he's the George, remember the George C. Scott says, we'll buzz in it, you know, roast their chickens and whatnot. So that was showing the mentality that was prevalent in there. And by the way, Dr. Strangelove is a caricature of Henry Kissinger.
I assume the Soviets had the same problem, right?
Absolutely. We had U-2s going in, right?
Yeah.
So we had U-2s, and this is where Oswald comes in, because that was his job in Atsugi, Japan. Oswald was a very bright cookie. He was sheep-dipped. That's what is called when the CIA goes into the military, picks up a talented individual, takes them up, dips them, comes out black, white sheep to black sheep. Sheep.
Okay.
So Oswald was a radar controller for the U-2 when he was in Atsugi, Japan. Then he came back stateside, and suddenly he decides to leave the Marines and defect. He goes over there, gets a job in the Minsk radio factory.
That doesn't make any sense to me at that time. It's a great story, isn't it?
Right. It was his. Well, the Russians didn't believe it. And one of the reasons, of course, was they can smell a spy. Yeah. And Oswald was refused a visa. And this is where this really mysterious event occurs, where I think, honestly, I told this to my friend earlier today on the other radio show, I don't think the guy that was killed in Dallas was the real Lee Harvey Oswald. Because his brother, Robert Lee Oswald, wrote a book about him.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, he gives at least four instances where he communicated to me, the reader, that this guy was not his brother.
Could the real Oswald have been that guy who was in that picture at the embassies in Mexico?
Not at all.
Okay.
That guy, you know, that guy, I thought, you know, it's more likely that that's Jack Ruby with his hair dyed. blonde than that it's Oswald. The guy is stocky. He looks Slavic. He's burly, you know? And you know what? That picture, the CIA cited and claimed to the Warren Commission that they had a picture of Oswald coming out of the embassy. And then it was the House Select Committee on Assassinations that pried it from them. So the big lie was institutionalized right there. They had to hide that they were the hand in the glove. May I use that analogy? The mafia was the glove. The CIA was the hand in these plots.
And they're working in tandem.
Lyndon Johnson was such a cagey guy. He was a pathological killer and a pathological liar. But even the pathological liar, deep in his soul, the soul wants to tell the truth. And when he spoke to Walter Cronkite after he was out of office, he made the most amazing statement in a very frank way to Walter Cronkite. He said, "We were running a murder incorporated in Latin America in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And he said, "we." He didn't say they, you know?
Yeah.
And this is the way the psychopath learns to tell the truth indirectly. Now, can I get back to Sheffield Edwards? This is really
wonderful. I want to wrap things up with you with some final calls. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Sheffield Edwards, his name stuck out when I first read this memo about a certain CIA agent, George Bush, and Sheffield Edwards having debriefed the Cuban community about how they felt about the Kennedy assassination and came back with expressions of regret and sadness because they had hoped that relations with Cuba were improving. So that eliminated the anti-Castro Cubans in their eyes, you know, as a result of this report. It's an FBI memo. So that's where Sheffield Edwards appeared. Then I read Corso's book, The Day After Roswell.
Yes.
And Corso says, "I met with Sheffield Edwards, the number three man in UFOs at the CIA."
How about that?
Then I read, I like to give my sources, right? Everything I've told you about the plot on Castro comes from CIA men. It comes from the autobiography of Richard Bissell, the autobiography of Richard Helms, and the autobiography of the confessions of H.L. Hunt.
Okay, Howard Hunt.
Okay, so Sheffield Edwards is a big wig, both in UFOs and in this 5412 committee. He was the recruiter for the mafia. At the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they were tailing Jack Anderson. He broke the story, you know. Jack Anderson, he broke the story about the mafia.
He was on top of it.
But they were, listen to who they were tailing. They were tailing Jack Anderson and his assistant, a young reporter who was starting out as his assistant, Britt Hume, who is now in at Fox News.
That's right. Were they going to kill them?
Well, if they had to, it seems like they let them go just so far. But if they went any farther, in exposing how intimate the relationship was, I think they might have knocked them off. They didn't have any qualms about eliminating people who heard too many bullets in Dealey Plaza or threatening nurses who saw an extra bullet hole on the side of the head of President Kennedy. That was Wilma Tice. And so it was a very, very sinister, a sinister time.
How many people, Robert, do you think might have been involved in this assassination? 5, 10, 20?
Well, it depends on at what level. If you're talking about mechanics, that's what the guys with the rifles, I call them the mechanics, you know, the guys who really did the thing in Dealey Plaza.
Yeah.
And I can count you a shooter in the Texas School Book Depository who hit nothing, a shooter in the Daltex building who was probably Charles Nicoletti, because I found a picture of Charles Nicoletti standing next to the sheriff in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Okay. And I believe he was in one of Zapruder's offices. Zapruder had a fourth floor office and an empty third floor office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the back shot between the shoulder blades came from the Daltex building. But there was somebody up on the county records building who fired a shot that hit Kennedy on the side of the head and then went on to hit Connolly. And this had to have been somebody. Well, the county records building is where the sheriff's office is. See? Now, I sent you a picture earlier this evening of a vapor trail that I found in frame Z295 of the Zapruder film, which is the track. You can see the incoming, the deflection. It actually went into his head and out of his head, and then left the hole and the exit hole. And the vapor trail continues in the direction of Governor Connolly. At Z295, that passes by. That's a shot. And 1 second later, 18 frames later, at Z313, we have the mortal head wound, which begins a series of shots, a sequence of shots. And I'm going to explain to you how this thing really happened. I gave this information to Dr. Cyril Wecht in 1998.
I know, Cyril, what a great pathologist who
and
believes
he now,
that.
He now voices this. I was thrilled to hear him telling this on the History Channel. I said, the only thing that it can explain all the wounds is this scenario. First, there were two shooters, one on the grassy knoll and one on the porch. The one on the porch fired first. This is talking about something that was half a second to maybe 1 second apart.
Yeah. And all in radio communication, I bet, right?
Right. Well, yes. And there's actually a figure in the Alkin picture. You know, James Alkin took the picture of the limousine with President Kennedy having been shot in the throat and falling. You're looking through the windshield at the driver looking back, but you have the whole crowd, or almost the whole crowd. On the left side of that are two men, one with a fedora hat, one with a black suit and a hat, and his face is blocked out. But he has his hands up in the air with this object, and it says to me that that's the guy that was transmitting and that was picked up on the dicta belt. He was up there holding a mic and a walkie-talkie to catch the sounds, to transmit them to somebody.
Good.
I met Hal McLean, you know, the motorcycle cop?
Yeah.
The one who had the extra bullet. His mic was stuck.
That's right.
And he looked me in the eye. He says, my mic was not stuck. That was not me. And he was adamant. Another time we can have a talk about all these incredible people.
Oh, we got to get you back for more. Robert, let's wrap things up with some calls for you, okay?
Sure.
They're lining up for you. Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the program. Joe, go ahead.
How are you, George? Mr. Morningstar, you're just talking a little bit about the shots. Do you know anything about John K. Latimer's study on the ballistics of the Kennedy assassination?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I debated Dr. Latimer in 1994. I was invited by the Harbor Defense Museum in Brooklyn, and you're in Bronx, but down in Brooklyn and over there by Fort Hamilton, there's this Harbor Defense Museum. And they invited Dr. Latimer and me to debate each other in 1994. And I went down there with my information and my pictures. And when he made his presentation, and then I made my presentation, like a rebuttal. And then I said, Dr. Latimer, come over here and look at these pictures. And when I started showing him the autopsy pictures, which are not President Kennedy, they are a substitute body. That was the brain of this man that's in the pictures, and his head and his face. He was a lookalike of President Kennedy, whom I've identified as Officer Tippit. I call Tippit the getaway vehicle of the JFK assassination, because Tippit was intentionally slain in a particular, what I call it, a surgical execution. The man he stopped got the drop on him. Let's use a Western lingo.
Right.
Got
yes.
the drop on him. Tippit stepped out. He obviously knew the man. You see, so he didn't step out drawing his gun. He talked to the guy for a little while. He said, okay, step out. So he stepped out, was walking across the car. The man fired across the hood, put three bullets in his chest, and then walked over to the dying Tippit, kneeled down, put the gun to his temple, and fired one shot that went through his brain in a rising angle that hit the back of the head. And that is the brain. When I discovered this in Jim Bishop's book, I thought I solved the case, and I really do believe I did. But I thought I only had the brain. As the years went by and I looked for more and more pictures of Tippit, slowly the day came when it dawned on me, and I looked at the photographs, and I said, oh, my God, this is not President Kennedy. This is J.D. Tippit. shaved, dressed up.
Looked just like him.
Well, I know who did it, John Leggett. There's a History Channel program that they don't show anymore. That's the one where they laid it on Lyndon Johnson's lap, the men who killed Kennedy. So Lady Bird and the family sued them, and they agreed not to show it anymore. But in that, they told about John Leggett, who
Robert, I got to tell you, though, great research. Where the clock, of course, has got us in what is one of the fastest four-hour programs I've ever participated in. But we've got to get you back in. Robert, the Morning Star, of course, and his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. 50 years ago, America went through one of the most tragic episodes of its history, and still to this day, it has never been the same. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.